What have you been writing lately?
Well, I've been working on a number of different things. One is I have a doing a rewrite on a movie about the first Indianapolis 500. I'm also doing a movie about a small town in Tennessee who were in the category of the last to integrate their high schools. And it's about what happens during a year to that town, how it comes about. I'm also supervising a couple other projects, which I'm actually not writing, but I'm supervising the writing of.
Who was the first screenwriter that you really noticed their work?
That's a good question, and I suppose it came about when I became and I started studying actual directors, and I was aware of my favorite director growing up. Who I became aware of that there was such a thing when I was probably 11 or 12 years old was David Lean, and he had the same screenwriter who wrote Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, Bridge Over the River Kwai, and that was Robert Bolt. The first film I remember seeing that he did was probably Bridge Over the River Kwai. But I consider the next film I saw the greatest film ever made, and that was Lawrence of Arabia.
I got to see that on a giant screen at the Fox Theater in Detroit when I was 19, and that
well,
changed my life.
Well, that's the only way to see it.
Indeed.
On a giant screen.
It's only been two Lean films because I was actually 14 when Passage to India came out, and now it's just hard to find good prints of those particular films.
That's true. I mean, he did other films that have their value. Ryan's Daughter was another film that didn't quite work as well as the others, but it was a spectacular-looking film. It's very difficult to describe to my younger boys, and I have a 14-year-old who's interested in films, what the experience was like to watch 70-millimeter or Cinerama-sized films in theaters. Like, no, they don't exist anymore, and those prints don't exist anymore. I would put in, you know, he looks like an old fossil, like El Cid, and think, what am I thinking? But I love that movie, and I also love Ben-Hur. I mean, all those epics, biblical epics. I was a big fan of going into the theater and being transported into another world, another time, a place, and you know, the whole kind of romantic, chivalry, historical aspect about those films was extraordinary for me. I think it's the reason I fell in love with movies, were those kind of movies.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned David Lean and the director writer team. I've recently finished the Billy Wilder box set that MGM put out, the 60s and early 70s. And to a certain degree, you could say that you and David are a team, especially with the three films you've worked on. Do you think that it just seems like the writer-director teams is also a lost art?
There's no question about it. And, yeah, you're talking about I.A.L. Diamond. He was an extraordinary writer, another one who was great. And an example that his best work was with Billy Wilder. And when he worked with others, it wasn't quite as good. You know, they had a magic chemistry. Now, David and I actually worked together a little bit differently than most writer-directors, insofar as most writers are not producers. I didn't write my first script until I had probably produced about 10 movies and worked in the film business for 6 years. Producer, supervisor role kind of capacity. I really knew how to make movies before I knew how to write a script. And it was that training that helped me figure out a intelligent way and a way that was on budget, or at least put together a reasonable budget for Hoosiers. David and I were roommates in college. So when we, in our movies, we did everything together. We cast it together. We went on locations and picked locations together. We crewed it up, and we were just toe to toe. I mean, it is a highly unusual. You're probably more like the Coen brothers than Billy Wilder and I.L. Diamond.
You should have done the screenplay for Wise Girls.
Well, yeah, that's. You know, I came in. I did a pass about a 10-day pass. Well, it took me about a week, and the problem was I'd committed to doing a workshop. So, and he went on location, and they would send me pages, and I would do rewrites and send them back. So it was kind of, I came in at the last minute, and I didn't really, I think it's very difficult to put one's own stamp unless you're writing a first draft. Because the characters' voices come from another person. You're just trying to adapt, you know, what you think that they would say under that circumstances. It's not my best. I never do my best work unless I'm creating my own character, find their voices, and tell the story through them. I've done rewrites. I don't like doing them because I feel like I'm just an average guy, average rewriter. I'm not a very good, I can figure out what's wrong with the script, but actually creating great scenes with great dialogue, it's tough for me because I'm mimetic and not organic.
Any chance of directing full-time? I mean, being...
Well, I've been attached to a number of different projects. Unfortunately, none of those projects have gone forward, but I've made many deals with different studios to write and direct. And just haven't gotten those scripts off the ground.
Okay.
It would be a very easy transition for me.
How many people approach you outside of Indiana to talk about Rudy and Hoosiers? Because it seems like, you know, you're invited into anybody's home in this state.
Of course. I mean, the films have a following, not just in the state. I mean, you've seen that some of the polls where our movies end up. I mean, we've been at number one sports film in about five or six different polls and publications, and and Rudy has a following. It's been all over the world. You don't have to love Notre Dame football. You don't have to give a damn about Indiana basketball to like those movies.
How hard, did I read right, it was Rudy and Newt Rockne are the only films that have been shot on Notre Dame's campus?
That's right.
How were the negotiations on getting that pulled off?
It was very difficult, and I actually didn't, there were many times we didn't think it was going to happen. We had a lot of things kind of had to fall into our place, and had to fall into place for us to pull it off. One was, Hoosiers had to exist.
Mm-hmm.
We had to have a model that demonstrated our values, our sensibility. And there was one person who made the decision, and that was the president of Notre Dame at the time, Father Beauchamp. And he said to us, and I'm paraphrasing him somewhat, but, you know, you're not one of the outsiders, you know, the Hollywood people. You're locals. You're part of the tribe, and we trust that. And the second thing and the most important thing was the script. And he said of all the scripts that he was involved with reading over the period of time he was there, this is the only one that really captured the sense of the spirit, the values, what Notre Dame was all about. Mm-hmm. And did not try to exploit it or make light of it or even romanticize it. So, and the fact that it was a true story. There was a lot of resistance at the athletic department. I mean, the athletic director did not want us on campus. There was a feeling, there were two parts of that negative response. One was, they didn't want anything to disrupt their world, their team. They didn't want any distractions around. But the secondary issue was, with as many great players as Notre Dame has had, the pantheon filled with Heisman Trophy winners and Hall of Famers and so on and so forth, why there wasn't a agreement by the president to allow this film that celebrated some little end of the bencher who played 27 seconds was incredulous to them. So we overcame a lot of resistance during the shoot because they were not cooperative. They had to have a gun held to the head to do anything with us. So.
How was the reaction after the film came out?
You know, the thing that's interesting is that they have a, I think it's a, how do I put this without being too offensive to the people at Notre Dame? They have a built-in arrogance over there in the football department.
No. Really?
The truth is, we never got any acknowledgement at all from Notre Dame or the athletic department. None. Now, having said that, I can't tell you how many anecdotes and little press things that I've been sent that various people over the years who have committed to play it at Notre Dame first fell in love with Notre Dame after having seen that movie, or that movie actually having an effect on picking Notre Dame, even to this day. And of course, the awareness of the program and what was special about it was the initial exposure to a lot of kids who were, you know, athletes, 10, 11, 12, 13. And I'm not saying it's the reason they signed their letter of intent, but it has been a factor. Mm-hmm. But we've never been invited back there. We've never heard a word one from anybody on the campus of Notre Dame.
Well, they're too busy paying off Charlie Weiss's contract.
Well, you know, I will say one thing that about Notre Dame, and this is a positive thing.
Okay.
Their new athletic director, Jack Swarbrick, is a great guy. I worked with him on the campaign to bring the Super Bowl to Indianapolis in 2011. And I think they really made a very smart hire. And I think I'll be invited back up there at some point next year because he's a friend.
That's good. Now, with Hoosiers, I heard the story that you had to keep moving the extras from one shot to another.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The extras that you had in Hoosiers, as far as you had to move them from one section of the gym to another.
Right.
Because it's funny because now there's at least 8,000 people that all claim to have been extras in Hoosiers.
Oh, believe me, I have that same frustrated feeling. Yeah, where were you? Oh, we were there? Yeah, I probably talked to every one of those 8,000. I actually had a weird experience the other night. I went to watch Franklin Central play Lawrence North at Hinkle Fieldhouse. It was the first time I had been back there since, I think it was a couple of years later, there was some sort of banquet for honoring the original teams, Muncie Central and Milan. But that was the first basketball I'd ever seen on that court. Mm-hmm. And I walked in there, and I actually got waves of nausea thinking about how hard it was to fill up those seats, how endless it seemed. No matter how many people we got in there, it was like a big sponge. It just sucked them up, and it still looks sparse. I mean, those are days way before CGI or
right.
You know, even the kind of thing they did in Seabiscuit, mm-hmm. which is cardboard cutouts.
Are you familiar with Bill Simmons writing on ESPN.com?
Very well. In fact, Bill did a whole thing on Hoosiers that was hysterical.
I love the fact that he tried to do the box score for the team.
Yes, that was great. He's terrific. He's one of the best around, and I had a number of email exchanges with him, complimenting him on that piece.
So was he right on with the stats?
Well, you think I would have spent time trying to figure that out?
Well, we don't know how dense a writer you are at home, you know.
Well, first of all, the way in which we constructed that game was based on getting our boys out there let me go back and say first, the only way in which we were able to pull off that final game is that we got the agreement of the two top high schools in Indianapolis to actually have a game there. And we had five cameras, and we filmed those guys playing 20 minutes as hard as they could. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is just found footage along the way. Now we set up and reconstructed the last 45 seconds or 40 seconds, we had moved everybody who agreed to stay on one side. So there wasn't any real detailed writing because we couldn't reconstruct it. We didn't have the time, the money, or the crowd to do so.
Now, can you watch sports films now? No?
No, I don't. I can't.
It's too painful?
You know, if I anticipate that there's going to be a coach in a locker room giving a speech, I'm going to stay as far away as I possibly can from that movie. I mean, my two young boys who are great athletes and who are interested in seeing those films, but their mom tapes them, not me.
What if Pride of the Yankees or Fear Strikes Out comes on?
Yeah, you're talking about something that was filmed in the past?
Not necessarily.
I actually can't stand either one of those movies. First of all, any film that would cast Anthony Perkins as a baseball player. I mean, you see him throw a ball.
Yes, I did. He climbs a net well.
Well, you know, it's such a critical aspect of the whole suspension of disbelief, especially people who know sports, is that you cast somebody who can play it. I mean, De Niro was horrible and banged the drum slowly. I mean, it ruined the movie for me. A guy can't throw a baseball. It was critical to us when we were making films that we did not have anybody groan when we saw somebody take a jump shot or throw a football. And we had Vince Vaughn, who claimed that he was a great thrower. We didn't have time to work him out. He showed up at the set, and the first time he went back, and because he was slotted to play the quarterback. It was cast to play the quarterback. And he went back, and he threw the ball, and it floated up in the air about 20 yards. It was like, we had to change that part. Move him to halfback. And then when there was a halfback pass, double him. We actually took lines away from him and reduced his role too.
How many names are now listed for your soccer film? There's because I heard two. I wasn't sure if there were more.
Yeah, but there were only two. And,
okay.
And I'll tell you the reason behind it. When we it was a disastrous distribution and marketing and release. The company that made it, Bristol Bay Productions, tried to get major distribution, and they couldn't. And one of the reasons they couldn't was the film cost more than the marketing projections had in their study. So they had to distribute it on their own. They decided to tank the movie. And they spent $750,000 for the opening weekend of only 100 theaters. Then basically pulled the movie, sold it to Disney for a DVD, and Disney did not want that film, The Game of Their Lives, because they were releasing another DVD of a film that was similar to theirs called The Greatest Game Ever Played, which was a golf film. And so they wanted to differentiate the two, and they came up with Miracle Match. Miracle, they felt that it would be actually positive because it would be right next to their other great movie, Miracle, in the DVD store. We had no say-so. Obviously, we were cut off from any decisions in that area. And those are the only two titles that I know of.
Somewhere down the road, do you think there will be a release? Because I thought it was also a half hour longer. Did I read right?
Well, I wish it had been a half hour longer. I could probably talk to you for more than an hour of... Let me restate that.
Okay.
I've actually thought about reading a book, writing a book, rather, entitled Anatomy of Success, Anatomy of Failure, and it would be about Rudy and Hoosiers and the game of their lives. How everything seemed to click and went right for us on the first two movies, and how everything, it was like Murphy's Law, everything seemed to go wrong. We had the worst combination of luck and personnel who did not rise to the occasion. And our production company and the people and our executives and producers behind us were a disaster. And just one little part of that is that when David and I did our first cut, it was about a little longer, 2 hours and 3 minutes. And we actually did a test market screening in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And it was very successful. But the company that... the main company had a change of presidents. So a new guy came in, and he was like the maven. He was like the expert. And he basically said, okay, guys, he said, you know, this story just doesn't move quick enough. Said, you need to take a half an hour out of the movie. And we were incredulous. In fact, David walked. David, you know, when he said you have no choice, David walked off the movie. And he had somebody else come in. Actually, it was him. It was like the president of the company and some editor. They just hacked a half an hour out of the movie. And it was so many of the storylines just disappeared. And it moves, but you have no connection to the characters. You don't really know why you should care about them. And there were some interesting backstories that would have made the film much more dimensional, and I think would have made a much stronger rooting interest for the audience.
Well, here's hoping it becomes the sports version of Touch of Evil, and we get to see what it really looks like.
Well, who knows? I think it's highly unlikely that we'll get a director's cut, only because those kind of films only happen when there's some marginal success with those films, whereas we did not have enough success to put any money into a director's cut.
What films have you seen recently that you've enjoyed?
Gladiator. I screened films for my son that he wasn't old enough to see, or was too young to see, because Gladiator is a pretty violent film.
Yep.
And I go through and TiVo if I see something, older classic, and we watched that the other night, and I thought that's the best film Ridley Scott's ever made. It really, really works. One of the great, demented, over-the-top performances, Joaquin Phoenix. And I'll miss that guy if he's truly gone, because he's a special actor.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a little bit of the old style of the epic films that I liked. They didn't do it tongue-in-cheek. They did it straight. There were a lot of sincerity in the film. I think the other film that we saw recently that was one of my favorite films of the genre, the epic genre, and one of the few that's actually been that was effective, and that was Braveheart, another great film. I mean, I actually developed a movie with Mel Gibson, and I told him I really sincerely believed that was one of the best directed films I've ever seen. He's an underrated director. He really is. And I know you're asking me if I've seen any.
Oh, that's okay.
But the interesting thing is that I have not seen any recent films, although I have all of them stacked right next to my, my television set, because I'm a member of the Academy.
Yes.
They send me about 100 movies a year. And I didn't even vote this year because I didn't watch any of the films. And the reason is because when I'm actually writing a first draft, I don't like to watch other movies.
Sure.
I can't really lose myself in them. I can't have the suspension of disbelief. I'm looking at the architecture of the movie. When I finish my first draft here, this film that I'm working on now, I plan to watch a number of films.
Talk about a screenplay idea, Oliver Reed's Last Bar Bill.
You're talking about Gladiator.
Well, yeah, Gladiator meets Under the Volcano, only with Oliver Reed instead of Albert Finney.
Oh, God. Well, he's been in a lot of great movies.
I'm still waiting for most of Ken Russell's work to get on DVD, if somebody would be brave enough.
Well, those are films that came out in the 70s that were those of us who fell in love with movies, and I was in film school when some of those came out, in the 60s, not the 70s. We ate those films up. They were hallucinogenic, so over the top, but so filled with love of cinema that I think that they deserve to be brought back. And I think some of these movies, now that we have big screen televisions and they're going to get their due, you just can't get a sense of what these movies are like on these little tiny television sets.
Agreed.
And I watch people watch films on iPhones and, their little gaming systems. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, whenever my daughter wants to watch a movie in the car when we're traveling, I said, yes, but you have to watch this in the basement when we get back.
Right, right.
Angela, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.